My castaway this week is a composer. Early in his life, he enjoyed huge success. His first opera received rapturous acclaim in London when he was only 21. Illness and misfortune followed. His music fell out of favour and he retired to Dorset and grew mushrooms. But the musical establishment rediscovered him. Today, at the age of 81, he's one of this country's most successful composers. His latest work, A Symphonic Mass, was received at its premiere with what one newspaper called monster, raving, loony ecstasy. He is George Lloyd. So, despite a quarter of a century in the musical wilderness, your work is now published, it's recorded, it's being performed to sell out audiences. What's it like to be successful again?
It's really a wonderful way to spend one's latter days. I sometimes think of people I've known. For instance, when I was just starting, I met Cyril Scott, and he had been very, very, very famous in the early part of the century. People compared him to Debussy. But by the time I knew him, he was absolutely thrown away. Nobody would look at him. And he died in obscurity. And I often thought to myself, how lucky I am that I'm writing and full of life, and now people want to listen to my music.
But does that kind of success go to your head, or have you been
No, I think at my age one's seen too much disasters of one sort or another. No, it doesn't go to my head. At least I hope it doesn't.
Apparently, snatches of your music are played in pubs and discos these days. Well, in what form?
Well, I don't know. I don't go to discos and pubs, so I've never heard it. But it is perfectly true that a few years ago, when I was looking through my Performing Rights Society quarterly statement, they do it with signs and symbols, and this was a sign I'd never seen before. And I looked it up. I said, my God, I've succeeded. I'm being played in a disco. I was really, really, I thought that was fabulous.
But you're a tunes man, really, aren't you?
Well, yes, of course. I suppose I am a tunes man because music without melodies, without tunes, without singing phrases, to me, is just not music.
And so you believe that music is totally to feed the soul, is it? There isn't any intellectual purpose in it.
Well, it's difficult to be too hard and fast over that. If it's just what you call the soul, it can tend to be perhaps a bit sloppy. You've got to use your wits and use your brains, although that's not enough by itself.
Let's find out what will feed your soul or whatever on a desert island. What's your first record?
Well, my first record is a part of Heifetz playing Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto, and I just love that work. And, of course, Heifetz was what violinists called the sans-pareil. He was the ultimate in violin playing. And this is a great record. It's with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at their peak. Because I tried to be a violinist myself, I really appreciate this.
Part of the first movement of Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto, played by Yasha Heifetz with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Fritz Reiner. Tell me about your early success, George Lloyd. You must have been a very precocious young man to have had an opera staged in London at the age of 21.
I don't know whether it was being precocious. I'd been doing all my sort of normal studies, studying violin with Albert Sammons, and I did my composition and all the rest of it. But at the same time, my father used to put me through the ropes with opera because he was a person who had an enormous knowledge about, particularly all the very early operas. He would say, now, here's a scene from some play or other. Now, you go and set that. So I'd have to go and set that. And, of course, I...
How old were you when you did that?
Oh, I was about 16, 17. And because I started studying seriously music when I was 14 and a half. And I'd get stuck, and then he'd say, well, let's see what Rossini would have done in that situation. So I was sort of also brought up in the opera world. So it seemed to me perfectly natural that I should write an opera.
But was it his idea? Because he wrote the libretto.
Yeah, he wrote the libretto, yes.
But was it his idea?
We were asked to do this by a man who ran, a man called Walter Barnes, who ran all the music in Penzance, and that was part of my world. I was born in St. Ives, and we did it. It was an extraordinary piece of luck. The principal critic of the Times, Frank Howes, was there at the time, and he came along and heard
it. What, on holiday, was he?
He was on holiday, yes. And he walked in, and he wrote a really ecstatic, one of the best reviews I've ever had in my life, I think. And then everybody said, well, we can't let this die. It should be done in London. And, nobody would have looked at us if it hadn't been for that review that just set us up.
So in 1935 it went on in London.
That's right, at the old Lyceum Theatre, Irving's Theatre.
And a very distinguished audience, I gather.
Oh, well, all the bigwigs came along.
Beecham?
Beecham came, yes. He came along, stroking his little beard. He walked into the dressing room and said, very good, my boy, very good. You keep the interest going all the time. Well, that was a tremendous compliment from Beecham.
But the greatest accolade came from Vaughan Williams, didn't it?
Yes, he came in, and unfortunately, I was not an admirer of Vaughan Williams at that time. I do appreciate him now. At that time, I didn't, because I didn't like all that sort of folk music business. And he walked in with his big black boots and said, it isn't fair. I've been all my life trying to learn to write an opera, and here's this boy. So
wonderful.
But
You must have been bowled over.
Not really, because when people used to say all these nice things to me, I'd sort of go home and say, well, silly old fool, don't they know I'm not Verdi, you know, because I thought nobody could ever write music except Verdi. And what was I, just trying my best to write a tune or two?
Let's have your second record. It's one of yours, in fact.
Yes, John Sockman. I was commissioned by the Arts Council to write one of the three operas for the Festival of Britain. Vaughan Williams did one for Covent Garden, Pilgrim's Progress, Benjamin Britten did the Billy Budd for Sadler's Wells, and they asked me to do an opera for the Carl Rosa Company. Carl Rosa Company, of course, doesn't exist now, but at that time it was the principal touring company, and the idea was that this would go all over England to cheer people up a little bit, and that was partly why it has a cheerful end. Of course, I've been sworn at since then, because, you know, we don't have cheerful ends nowadays, very bad taste.
That was Sybil's aria from George Lloyd's opera John Sockman, sung by Janice Watson with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by the composer, my castaway, George Lloyd. So there was never any doubt that music was to be your life. It was your life from when you were very small.
Well, yes, there was always a tremendous amount of chamber music going on. My father was an excellent amateur flute player. My mother played piano and viola and all sorts of things. I grew up with quartets and trios and Bach being played on the flute.
And you were going to be a fiddler?
Yes, when I was about five, I started learning to fiddle with my mother. But when I was 8, 9 years old, when I should have been building up more of a technical foundation, I had a series of illnesses. In fact, I had rheumatic fever 3 times. I spent 9 months in bed at one time, and that rather put me back. But even so, by the time I was 14 or so, I put a pistol to my father's head and I said, you know, it's time I started studying music because I'm going to be a musician.
But in the end, composition took over, and you wrote your first symphony, I think, when you were 19, and you sent it off to the Bournemouth Municipal Orchestra. And heard not a thing, so you went after it.
Oh, yes, well, Sir Dan Godfrey was the big man. He ran the orchestra and did all the conducting. And after about a month, I hadn't had an answer to my letter, and I thought this was outrageous. So I got on the train, went down there, and I told the secretary who I was, and she said, well, wait a minute, I'll go and see if Sir Dan will see you. I waited about 5 minutes. Suddenly, the door opened, and a great, big, massive, bald, sort of red, bald head. He looked like a bull, and he had the score in his 2 hands, and he came right up to me, and he said, can't they teach you how to write triplets? How can my musicians play those with the snowman? I'm sorry, Sir Dan. Will you play my symphony? Oh, yes. So I then plucked up courage and said, would you let me conduct it? Oh, if you want to, yes, come along down. He was an extraordinary man.
Shall we have record number 3?
Well, as you've gathered, although I was very operatically orientated, I was also completely seduced from the chamber music that I'd been brought up with, and I just fell in love with brass and drums and everything. And Berlioz meant a tremendous amount to me in those days. So this record, I'd like to play the march from the Symphonie Fantastique.
Part of the 4th movement of Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, played by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Davis. So, by the time you were 25, George Lloyd, you'd written 2 operas and 3 symphonies, although your 2nd opera was not a successful production. But then war intervened, and rather disastrously for you. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, I tried to join the Navy, actually, but they didn't want to have me. I think my heart was a little bit dodgy. So I went into the Marine Bands. Now, at that time, all ships from cruisers upwards, cruisers and battleships, they had a Marine Band of 15, 16 players. When the ship was in port, they entertained and did all the rest of it, ceremonial stuff. But when at sea, they were down in the bowels of the ship doing all the gunnery stuff, all the clever stuff, you know. They weren't computers, but they were like computers. And all the information came in, and that went up to the turrets. And we were doing the Arctic convoys. And they were always very difficult, a tremendous amount of loss. And there was a bit of a scrap one day, and the ship was hit. Well, on one side of our position was the magazine, and on the other side were the oil tanks, and the oil tanks were broken, and down came all this oil, and most of the people were just drowned in horrible, thick, black oil. But I was a lucky one, and somehow or other I survived. I survived, but I was a total wreck after that.
You were put ashore, weren't you?
Well, yes. I eventually, after a month or so, I landed up in a naval hospital near Aberdeen. And I was there for quite some time. And finally, the doctors saw my wife. And they said, look, we can't do anything with your husband. They tried all their different tricks of this and that, even hypnotism and everything. But
so you were shell-shocked?
I was just plain shell-shocked, yes. I hadn't lost a limb or anything. I was just plain shell-shocked. I think this extraordinary business of being... we had to climb up these ladders with all this oil coming down. And I think the exertion of that or something, it just burnt out my nervous system. Mm. Anyway, I couldn't do a thing. I was just like a doll on the end of a string. And they told my wife I'd have to spend the rest of my life in hospital. And that was that. So, yeah, quite definitely. And, my wife, she's a brave soul, and she said, well, if you can't do anything, why don't you let me have a try? They said, well, you don't know what you're taking on. But at any rate, she took me away, and I lived in the country for 3 years. And it was an absolute nightmare for her. But little by little by little, I started to recover a bit. And then she took me out to her home in Switzerland, where I lived for another 3 years. And, of course, I always wanted to get better, you know. Nothing was going to stop me. And I started... doing little exercises, writing little tunes, trying to get my head to work on notes again. And eventually, I wrote a symphony. It was pretty agonising, but I wrote it. And it has a cheerful end, which a lot of people, they can't understand this. They think it's very cheap, really, that here was I had seen some of the Nazi side of the war, and why wasn't I writing something really grim, you know, just to show everybody? But I took a different attitude. Well, I was alive and everything was good again, so I wrote a rather buoyant type of ending.
And that's your
That was my fourth symphony, yes.
And it's your fourth Desert Island Disc?
Oh, yes, yes, so it is, yes.
Finale of George Lloyd's Fourth Symphony, played by the Albany Symphony Orchestra, conducted by George Lloyd, which stayed in the cupboard for 35 years, you say?
Yes, it did. Nobody wanted to know it, but it came out eventually. I think that should cheer me up, sitting on my desert island. I say, well, I may be here for 30 years, but eventually I'll get out of it.
Stick around long enough.
Yeah, stick around long enough.
So your confidence, though, was obviously restored by discovering you could still write music despite your awful experiences.
Well, yes and no. I was still a bit very diffident about everything. I couldn't meet people. I couldn't do anything. You know, I wasn't fit for the music world, really. But I had to write.
And then you got the commission from the Arts Council.
Then I got the commission for writing an opera. I managed to deliver it on time. And, there again, I'm afraid this sounds as if it's just one sequence of disasters. It wasn't well produced. Unfortunately, the conductor and the producer, they didn't merely not get on very well together. They literally hated each other, and they wouldn't even talk. So you can imagine the atmosphere. The only form of communication they had was through Sir Edward Downes. It was his first job in an opera house, and he'd been engaged to teach the cast this new opera. And these two coots, they had to communicate through him. I was never allowed to a rehearsal at all. And that really finished me.
To be fair, your story is borne out by the Times critic, which was, again, Frank Howes, I think. I've got a quote here from him. He said, the performance was too rough to do justice to the orchestral score.
I think he realised that they weren't really hearing what should happen. However, I've more or less wiped the slate clean over that, because last summer I was able to do a whole disc, about 78 minutes of music, which we call Highlights from John Sopman, and I had a lovely time. I had some marvellous singers and the Philharmonia Orchestra, and so I sort of put everything right.
But the sad thing was, of course, that it was the last opera you wrote. It was your third opera, and you haven't ever written another one. Now, that seems terribly sad to somebody whose natural antecedents are Verdi. I mean, do you blame yourself? Do you think you were oversensitive?
Well, I blame myself to a large extent, because it was partly a weakness of character, but also circumstances, in that all this shell shock did have a very serious effect on my character. I couldn't stand up to people. Whereas when I first started, I was quite aggressive and everybody was going to play my music, and that was fine. But after that, I just became very timid and lost confidence where other people were concerned. I still had confidence about writing my music, not where the rest of the world was concerned.
More music.
Well, my next record is the quartet from Rigoletto. And, of course, I must have a bit of Verdi. And I believe that Rigoletto is one of his greatest. The thing that I like most with this record, which is a quartet, is his ability to delineate characters through the melodic line. This is something which has completely gone out of modern composition. And in the quartet, you'll hear, first of all, there's the tenor singing his lovely cantilena, and then you have the mezzo coming in with little quick trippy notes, and then in contrast, there's the soprano, Gilda, lamenting at the top, and underneath there's Rigoletto groaning away to himself. And these four characters are perfectly shown in this one piece. It's a great piece of technique.
From Rigoletto, Bella Figlia dell'Amore, sung by Luciano Pavarotti, Joan Sutherland, Huguette Tourangeau and Cheryl Milnes, with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Richard Bonning. So you turned away from music, this was the early 50s, and you farmed carnations first in Dorset. Was that profitable?
Well, we did manage to build up quite a successful carnation nursery. But unfortunately, one day we'd had some very bad returns from the market, and so we got on the phone and said, you know, what's going on? The market man said, well, he said, you see, South Africans, they're sending in wonderful blooms, I mean, better than any English grower could possibly grow, because they've got the sunlight and everything, you know. And all they want is the cost of the transport. I said, well, how are they making their living? Oh, they don't want to make money on the flowers. They want pounds. They want sterling. And then they sell the sterling. Mm. So I saw the red light. I said, well, we can't compete with that. We've got to do something else. And I looked around and thought, well, there was still a good opening for mushrooms. So what a dreadful life. Fancy spending all one's life there, locked up inside these black places. But, you know, my wife and they became absolutely fascinated. They're extraordinary things. And they suited my character also, because if something went wrong with the carnations, well, it stayed wrong for about 9 months. But with mushrooms, every week there was a new crop coming in. And, well, if the previous crop had been very, very bad, because things are never perfect when you're growing things. By the time you were ready to cut your throat, you got a new one, and that would be a great success. So it was lovely. And
so you did all that for about 20 years, didn't you?
We did that for a good many years. By the end of the 60s, we were hoping that we could get out of this. And all of a sudden, in the very early 70s, there was an explosion in land prices. In 1 year, the value of land trebled in Dorset. So we thought, well, now's the time. And we were very fortunate. We sold in 1973. We came to London.
And back to the music scene.
And back to the music, yes. But I was totally unknown, and nobody wanted to do a thing for me. It was absolutely hopeless.
Record number six.
Record number six is quite different to anything else. It's the Carnival de Vienne played by Moritz Rosenthal, and it's been recorded off a piano roll. Now, I'm talking about sort of mid-60s, I'd become very interested in the piano. I'd written a piano concerto. That was about the only thing that of mine which was played for 20 years or so. And John Ogden did it in Liverpool. And we sort of struck up a friendship. He liked what I wrote, and I thought his playing was absolutely fabulous, you know, and just suited me. And he used to come down and stay with me sometimes. And I just heard this piano roll with Rosenthal and a lot of other wonderful pianists as well. So I sat him in a seat and I said, "Now, John, you just listen to this, because you pianists, you think you know how to play, but see what you think of this one." And he was absolutely shattered. After that, he went home and he told me later that for the first time in his life, he actually started practising. He'd never practised. He was just born as a pianist.
Carnival de Vienne, played and composed by Moritz Rosenthal. You've said publicly that the reason, one of the main reasons anyway, you were out of favour for so long was that you were on a BBC Radio 3 blacklist. Now, do you have any proof of that?
I think probably there wasn't an actual physical list, but it amounted to the same thing. And there were other composers also in the same boat as me. I was just told that if I sent a score to them, they didn't even look at it. But I don't want to dwell on that too much, because they did make amends. They made amends very handsomely. It was mainly due to John Ogden. One day he'd been down to see me, and he went back with two or three of my symphonies. And unbeknownst to me, one of these got sort of slipped through the net. And the first thing I knew was, because he never told me, the first thing I knew was that BBC wrote to me and said that in due course they would play my Eighth Symphony. Well, that was fine. I waited a couple of years and nothing happened, so I thought, well, I'd better find a conductor. So I wrote to Ted Downes, who was then conducting in Australia at the Opera House, and it took him about a year to answer the letter. In actual fact, from the time they said that they would play this, it took them 8 years. They played it in 1977. I'd become totally disillusioned about everything at that time. And so I thought, they'll play this and that'll be the end of that. But what happened was I had so many letters from the public saying how they'd enjoyed this work that I said to myself, well, I've just got to pick myself up and try again.
So that was 1977.
That was 1977.
And this was the big turning point.
Yeah, this was the big. This was a really turning point in my life. So I got around and I thought, well, I must see all the orchestras again, and not one of them would do anything, until I went to the Philharmonia. And there was an extraordinary young man who was the manager. He was only 28 at that time, Gavin Henderson. And he was one of these rare people who says yes before he says no. And he listened to the tape of the symphony, and he liked it, and he said, now, what we're going to do is I'm going to get Larita, Mr. Itter, and Larita at that time was a very, very prestigious record label, meant a tremendous lot. And I'm going to get him to record it, and we'll play it at the Festival Hall. And lo and behold, that actually happened. Yeah. And then he managed to persuade BBC to do my Fifth Symphony and my Fourth Symphony. And then all of a sudden, people's attitude changed completely. He's had a symphony recorded. He's had two symphonies recorded. Three symphonies recorded. And after that, it sort of snowballed.
They call it your Indian summer. Do you resent that slightly?
I don't mind the very slightest bit, as long as they go on playing things for me.
Record number 7.
Although I did start loving operas and everything, I also loved all the English orchestral music. And I think that the greatest symphony that an Englishman has ever written or ever likely to write is Elgar's Second Symphony. So I'd like to have that.
Part of the first movement of Elgar's Symphony No. 2 in E-flat, played by the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Sir John Barbarolli. A desert island would, of course, be the ideal place to write another opera. I mean, how do you write? Could you sit on a desert island and do you feel the music inside your head? Or is it a more intellectual process than that?
No, I'm afraid it's not an intellectual process with me. Something comes along inside me, and if I don't write, I actually fall ill. It's almost a physical thing with me. It sort of takes the whole of my body. It takes everything.
So what are you going to do on your desert island?
Well, I have no writing paper. I have nothing.
No.
I have nothing. So, well, this will be very good exercise. I shall have to try to learn to write my music and store it in my memory, and that's going to be very hard. So I shall occupy myself for months, years, learning how to do that.
Tell me about your last record.
Well, the last record, in some ways, I think it's almost the most beautiful one of the lot, because it's Lee Patti playing Bach's Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, and I just think that he plays this like nobody else I've ever heard. And I want to have this because I find that even now, if I'm in a bad temper or I've been very agitated or if everything's gone wrong for me during the day, if I play that piece, it sort of soothes me down. So if I'm on the desert island and I get very irritated by all the awful things, I mean, I can imagine there'll be fleas and insects and all sorts of things which will come and make me very cross. So then I'll just play this wonderful piece.
Bach's Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, played by Dino Lipatti. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, which one would you choose?
Well, if you had to play a thing 100 times, which one lasts the best? I almost think that Bach would last better than anything else. So depends on one's mood, doesn't it?
Dino Lipatti, you hold on to.
Yes, all right, we'll keep that one.
What about your book?
Ever since I was a boy, I have loved Langland's Piers Plowman, and I like to read it in the original Middle English. And you have to have a dictionary with you because it's very, very difficult. But the sounds are simply gorgeous. And I've never, ever managed to get to the end. I start and I say, this is great, and after a certain length of time, something or other comes along. I've never got to the end. So as I'm going to have plenty of time, I'm going to tap Piers Plowman.
And your luxury?
I imagine that I would have been able to build a little cabin of some sort. And so inside it, I want a good picture. Any one of the great English portrait painters of the 18th century, which would sort of remind me of civilization.
Which is your favourite?
Because we started this programme with violins, I think I might have Romney's portrait of Lady Hamilton, because she played the violin. And so I'll have this lovely portrait. I'll have her.
George Lloyd, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you.